You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
I don't want to disfigure Sam for the purpose of this podcast. I want to explain it the way I remember it. People remember things not the way they happened, but they remember the things the way they need to remember them to make themselves feel better about themselves. I don't want to do that for this podcast. I don't want to do that for the discussion. I want to remember it exactly the way it happened, whether it reflects well on me or reflects poorly on me, because this podcast should be not only interesting from a human perspective, but this podcast should be educational. Someone should want to listen to this podcast and say, okay, I don't want to be in the predicament that Anthony's in, or I don't want to get snookered by a Sam Bankman-Fried. So let me listen to this podcast. Let me understand the whole context of what happened as a cautionary tale for me when I'm dealing with people. Sam's life was centered around his work, and Sam's life was centered around the community that he built at FTX. He was a workaholic. He was working an 18 to 20 hour day. He was known to literally sleep at or near his desk and get started for work the very next day after taking those sorts of cat naps. He's not a traditional executive by any means. He did not run the thing traditionally. He had a lot of, obviously, ultimate power over everybody. He did tell a fib related to Alameda. You know, when you were researching FTX and considering making an investment in it, he made it very clear that he was separate from Alameda and that he had nothing to do with it anymore. And there were people running it. Yes, it was his money, but there were clear guidelines and all conflicts of interest were vetted and transparent. And Wall Streeters are comfortable with that, by the way, because Goldman Sachs has a prop desk. Goldman Sachs can be a client of itself at Goldman Sachs. There's a protocol and a procedure that's used. And I think Sam played to that. He knew that the Wall Streeters would have no problem with Alameda being a client of FTX, right? The same way Goldman Sachs is a client of Goldman Sachs. You know, that's part and parcel for Wall Street. And so, you know, Sam had a very well-conceived idea of what he was doing. And he was a very hard worker executing on that idea.
One of the things that I think has been a common factor across crypto and does feed into broader narratives is, in some ways, I think because we have been in this zero interest rate environment, a lot of these tech company founders have come off looking like geniuses. And some of them really are. You know, you go back to like a Steve Jobs. That's a guy who came in and really did change the world, as we say. But I think that over time, that has gotten dumbed down and turned into a pitch on a venture capital deck where like, oh, we have a founder who wears a hoodie and he's a nerd and he's smart. And so this cult of smart, and particularly the cult of, oh, that guy's a lot smarter than me, so I'm going to give him my money. I think that really lies at the core of a lot of these issues. And I think that the other side of it is, honestly, the macroeconomic environment for working people, particularly in the United States, is so bleak that the desire to get, you know, even the off chance to get 100x on your investment becomes like this hypnotizing drug for people, and their critical faculties switch off. They already can't pay their bills, and so why not give $100 or $1,000 to this guy who might change my life? Who knows? And so we live in this gambling economy, not just in crypto, but more generally. And I think that that is a huge problem. If you bought Bitcoin near the top in 2021, you're better off now than if you bought Peloton at the top, which is pretty wild. So yes, I mean, it definitely had an impact, and there were a lot of, things that wouldn't have passed muster in a tighter environment, that got funded. Obviously FTX faced minimal due diligence. And that's been going on for a long time, right? Like going back to 2013, 2014, that's, I think, really when venture capitalists had too much money and really started letting companies compete for them instead of the other way around, which is just sort of you're meddling with the primal forces of nature at that point. And so it's crypto is one expression of that broader phenomenon.
Mr. Chairman,
what premises the gentleman seek recognition?
At this time, Sam is hiring professional help in Washington. He has a Washington office. His brother has a PAC funded by Sam's money. I don't remember the exact name of it, but his brother and his mother are working on Democratic Party politics funded by Sam, sort of like a money ball statistical approach to politics, effective altruism or effective politics using all these statistical analytical tools. And he has a Washington policy advisor. You know, Sam has made a $5 million investment in Joe Biden's campaign. He gave to a whole host of political leaders in the 2020 election. So I don't meet Sam until June of 2021. But he is gearing up for the midterm elections, and we are talking about the midterm elections, and he wants to support a slate of moderate Democrats in the primaries, and he wants to support a slate of non-MAGA moderate Republicans in the primaries, which I believe he does both. And we are talking about it, but he's also spending time on Capitol Hill. He's meeting with regulators at the CFTC. I believe he meets with Gary Gensler, the SEC commissioner, at least twice, at least according to the public records. He goes on and meets officials at the White House. Some of that's to talk about pandemic prevention. But he is in Washington. He has a regular presence in Washington, and he's meeting with officials, and he's going over the agenda, what would be important to the industry. And Sam is a student of history, so he knows that good regulation gets started with industry leaders explaining to Washingtonians how to regulate. Let's go back to the 1933 Securities Exchange Act. If everyone recalls their history, Franklin Roosevelt said he needed to hire a thief to catch other thieves. And so he made Joseph P. Kennedy, John Kennedy's father, who was a stock market activist in the 1920s, and some say a nefarious one, he made him in charge of the SEC. And he said to Joe Kennedy, explain all the tricks, explain how we can expose all the tricks, and a result of which we'll put an appropriate regulation to make people trust capitalism more, and it'll further the growth of the capital markets if we have more trust and more disclosure. And I think Sam is a student of history. He understands this. So that's his mantra in Washington. I'm here to offer my advice and my perspective. I'm here to tell you that as a large-scale cryptocurrency exchange, I need to be regulated. It'll be better for the industry if I am. And these are the vignettes. These are the statements of a good actor. He's believed to be a benevolent good actor. He has this calm voice. He becomes a statesman at a very young age due to the perception of his net worth. And he's there saying, hey, I'm here to help you help us regulate the industry. sort of a Jerry Maguire approach to speaking to people on the Hill. Sam was giving off the aura that he was wiser than his years. What I would say about Sam is that Sam was giving off the image that he was unbelievably successful. And so you have guys on Wall Street working 30, 40 years, they're at the top of the food chain, they're worth $8 to $10 billion. And here's Sam Bankman-Fried, worked $16 to $20 billion, and he started this project 3 or 4 years ago. And people bought into that and believed it. I certainly did. And so you have this image, an aura, that someone is doing something at a very, very young age that is stupendous, a result of which he may have insight. He may be a Mozart, right? Remember, Mozart could write the opera, the concerto. He could do it at 5, 6, or 7, a result of which were people 30 or 40 that were stepping back and looking at the pristine nature of the music. So if you're intellectually secure, you would be open-minded to the idea that there might be a younger person than you who has figured out how to build a mousetrap that's working better than your mousetrap. And so how did he do that and why? And I think that's what made the allure and the curiosity around Sam. He was probably more outspoken than most 30-year-olds should be. He was probably talking more and listening less, which goes against the Alexander Hamilton song. But I will say this, it was because people were listening. It was because people had accepted him as being a prodigy. The average 30-year-old is not accepted as a prodigy. They should be talking less and listening more. Sam was the opposite. He was talking more, listening less. Remember, good fraudsters, they know that they need the patina of legitimacy. And the way to get the patina of legitimacy is you get a few very influential people as investors backing you. You know, the media creates people. If they're good actors, they rise to the media's expectation. If they're bad actors, they fall. The media also creates boom-bust cycles with people, whether they're good or bad. But, you know, in Sam's case, they like the story. Nerdy kid, son of Stanford Law School professors, went to MIT, wickedly smart. Made a couple $1 billion for himself, going to give it all away, drives in a Toyota Corolla. Let's prop him up. Let's write good stories about him. And by the way, even after he crashed and burned, the mainstream media was still writing good stories about him. You saw that. It was like very sympathetic to him. You then get the media establishment to like you. And then, of course, if you get the political establishment, you now have the trifecta of good imaging, right? Media establishment, political establishment, and influential investors backing you, okay? And so Sam artfully worked on those things purposefully. And you could say in some cases it became organic, but I'm going to make the statement that it was strategically planned from day one. I'm going to make that investment in the naming rights of the FTX arena. That'll show people how much money I have. I'm going to put my name on the umpire's badges. Okay, this is going to give me some credibility. Baseball, hot dogs, apple pie, and Chevrolet. I'm now one of the pillars of the American establishment. I'm affiliated with Major League Baseball, this 150-year-old plus institution. And so he's checking the boxes. Okay, he's a brilliant strategist. He's checking the boxes. And he's also nefarious. He's also recognizing that his Alameda trading account is doing well, but it could do way better if he has other people's money to use as rocket fuel for the Alameda account. And that's primarily why he sets up FTX.
So you don't come to it as a religionist. You don't come to it because you have some particular passion for cryptocurrency.
No.
You were just looking for an opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a little bit of right place, right time. Like, people were hungry for like new platforms at the time. And we had no idea how to get customers. That's why I thought it was going to fail. But I think we always felt pretty good on the product side, and you know, we just kept pushing forward there. And I think that like that's maybe part of the biggest thing, was like not just having a better product at the beginning, but like not stopping.
Right.
Once you get there, so many companies in tech and fintech and in crypto seem to just sort of like, they build a good product and they're like, great, we made it. Time to stop innovating.
We don't really see the cracks until after Crypto Bahamas. I think that Three Arrows speaks there, Voyager guys are there, Celsius guys are there. The market starts weakening into the month of May, and we start to see the cracks, and then we start to see the worry that people are perhaps over-levered, they've bet too big in the space, and they now have to unwind those transactions. And we're also experiencing some level of fraud where people have been overpromised, or there were terms and conditions that were in the guidelines that were disavowed. And so we have this amazing conference, lots of people there, great networking opportunities, but shortly after the conference, the cryptocurrency markets start to crash. Bitcoin itself goes from 69,000 to 48,000. So it's 69,000 in November 2021, ends the year at 48,000. You're like, okay, incredibly optimistic because it went from 17,000 to 48,000. The beginning of the year is rough on crypto, but it's also rough on the stock market. We are embarking upon a war. The Ukrainians and the Russians are going to fight a land war in continental Europe, the first major land war since the Second World War. And so the markets are creaking and Bitcoin is faltering. And the Fed is signaling that they're done with the free money policy. They're going to start raising rates and shrinking the Federal Reserve balance sheets. You're starting to see a collapse in prices, and that's ugly in some ways, but not so ugly in other ways, because you're like, okay, we're still up a lot. This is an exciting new industry. Certainly there's a consolidation period in a new industry. There's probably a pause here. Maybe Bitcoin goes to 40,000, maybe it goes to 30,000, but it's not gonna break because we've already got so many people now in the space. But what we don't know is lurking in the space is an abundance of fraud and an abundance of over-leverage and overconfidence. What we don't know, and we should know this, by the way, because we're old Wall Street hands, but we don't know, but we're reminded of the old adage that there are no new stories. There's just a remix of past stories. And so what do we know? The 1920s were loaded with Ponzi schemes and banksters. We were calling them banksters as these banks were overpromising people and selling false securities. What do we know? 1998, long-term capital management crippled the banking system by being wildly over-levered. What do we know? 2008, the world came to an end with over-leverage and a misunderstanding of risk. And now here we are in 2022. We have a new asset class that was doing well, and people got way too smug and way overconfident, and they were over-leveraged, and you could feel the creaks in the system. The seventh largest cryptocurrency, Terra Luna, which is basically a project that was built on Bitcoin. It was basically supposed to be a stable coin backed by Bitcoin. And so what does Terra Luna stand for? Well, Terra and Luna are conjoined. One is a stable coin that's supposed to issue itself and stamp it out at one US dollar, and its reserves are going to be backed by Bitcoin. Remember, a stable coin, people believe, is going to transform the world. Why is that? Well, if I have a stable coin that's pegged to the US dollar, I could eventually put that on my smartphone wallet. I could go into Starbucks and I could buy my Starbucks coffee with the stable coin. I could just flash over the stable coin over the blockchain to Starbucks. It's stable. It represents $1. Starbucks is getting the exact amount of currency that they want for the service or the good that they're providing you. And so a stable coin is a next iteration of the cryptocurrency situation. Stable coins represent what they say. They're stable, they're stability, and they represent a unit that's measurable in US dollars, that's constant. It should have very little to no volatility. What Terra Luna is saying is we're so bullish on Bitcoin that our reserves are going to be in Bitcoin, because all Bitcoin's going to do is go straight up. And as Bitcoin goes straight up, it's going to increase our mounds and mounds of reserves, the result of which we'll be able to hold the peg at $1. The other piece of Terra Luna is actually its own blockchain, okay? And so Terra and Luna are conjoined, and they trade as the seventh largest market capitalized cryptocurrency project in the cryptocurrency realm. However, Bitcoin at the time is a 60 vol asset, meaning its volatility, it could have a 60% swing in any moment, okay, as a result of its trading pattern. And so a team like SkyBridge, a conservative team like SkyBridge, our cryptocurrency research people would look at something like that and say, well, it would be impossible to have a stable coin backed by something that's that unstable, so we don't participate in it. It unravels, and Bitcoin does what Bitcoin has been doing for 13 years. It's 1 year of a crash, 2 years of a build, 1 year of an all-time high, and then another crash. And Bitcoin is crashing. And so the Terra Luna project is based on a foundation of sand. The sand is shifting, and a result of which it's causing this negative spin out of control. As Bitcoin is starting to crack the Terra Luna peg of $1 per stable coin, is starting to crack as well. The catalyst or the crack that starts to open up in the de-pegging is the Terra Luna guys are making a statement. Our coin is stable. Why is your coin stable? Well, we have $150 million of Bitcoin to back the $150 million of coin that's pegged at a dollar. Okay, if Bitcoin drops 20%, people go to Terra Luna and say, okay, excuse me, you now have $130 million or $120 million backing something that you're saying has $150 million. There's an imbalance now. What do you say? And those guys don't know what to say because now they're fucked. Okay, and so they say, we don't have the money backing the stablecoin. That causes a run on the bank. Okay, so just think of it from a fractional banking perspective. Let me take you back to It's a Wonderful Life. You put your money in the deposit at the Bailey Savings and Loan. They take your money, they lend it out to somebody to build a house. That person's paying interest. You're getting the float on that. You're getting an interest rate from the bank. The bank is making the spread. Now, all of a sudden, everybody gets panicked. They want their money out of the bank. Well, that's a bank run. Once the bank run happens, there's not enough money, and so the thing tumbles, and then the bank is forced to close. Unfortunately, markets find your level of vulnerability. Markets find your level of weakness. Terra Luna's under a lot of pressure, and then the selling starts in Bitcoin, which furthers the negative flywheel of Terra Luna selling more and more Bitcoin, which pushes Bitcoin down from the mid-40s into the 30s on its way down to 25. It eventually rests there as Terra Luna wipes out. And if you go on CoinGecko today, you know, Terra Luna, which was once trading at a dollar, is now at like 0.00001 cent or something like that. So that project is catastrophic because now it's creating contagion in the industry. So where is it contagion? Well, it's contagion things like hedge funds that are dedicated to cryptocurrency. The largest hedge fund out there that's dedicated to cryptocurrencies is Three Arrows. It's run by a group of guys. They've got tens of billions of dollars under management. They've had this explosive run in crypto, but they are wildly over-levered. And what do we know from Warren Buffett? You can see who is swimming half naked as soon as the tide comes out. Because if the tide runs out on these guys, they're caught, they're over-levered, they start a massive selling of their positions, but it's too late. The leverage, the borrowings, are bigger than the net asset value. And so as the assets are coming down, it wipes out the principal, and now you're stuck with a group of creditors. So these guys say, holy shit, we don't have the money to pay these creditors. They flee the locations that they're in because they're going to be sued for fraud and misrepresentation, and they go to non-extradition treaty places. there's a 3 ounce actually spoken salt. They then disappear. But you can't call something a stable coin and then back it with something as unstable as Bitcoin. And so thankfully Skybridge doesn't touch that. But we watch Terra Luna implode. And as Terra Luna is unwinding to try to protect itself, it's crushing Bitcoin. Bitcoin's going from 40 to 30 to 25.
David Morris, CoinDesk. The other aspect of it that I think can't be totally discounted is people simply not understanding what they're dealing with, not understanding the real point of any of this, and really not having enough intellectual depth to understand when an idea is bad. He I think has heard me say this several times. He's refusing to talk to us anymore. But I think that the cardinal case here in my book, or at least a really good exemplar, is Mike Novogratz, who was a former sort of mainstream Wall Street guy and got involved in crypto a little bit earlier than most. He bought a absolute truckload of Luna, this thing behind the Terra ecosystem and the UST stablecoin, which anybody with a first-year MBA or undergraduate degree in economics should have been able to see was an unsustainable, basically obfuscated Ponzi scheme. And so, like, Mike Novogratz goes in the Hall of Shame for this year. I mean, honestly, right up there with Sam Bankman-Fried. Like, he and other VCs, but I'm using his name as an analog for a lot of them. He got a Luna tattoo. He posted about it constantly on Twitter. He cost retail investors who followed him into Luna probably easily millions of dollars, probably tens of millions of dollars. I'm on a personal campaign to get him run out of the industry because I think that's a mistake that you don't get to climb back from reputationally. But these VCs get really amped about something. Maybe it's something they don't totally understand. They're under pressure to get it done as fast as possible because if they ask hard questions, they're going to get blocked out. And then because of the nature of crypto being sort of without a lot of barriers, you know, if a VC in a traditional market does that, it's not that big of a deal because it's not like anybody, for example, could go out and buy Theranos stock. But in this market, you essentially can go out and buy Theranos stock because, like, the walking corpse of Henry Kissinger tells you it's great. So that's the problem. That's the structural market problem that drives the particular tulip mania around crypto.
Tracy Wang, CoinDesk. The depegging of UST, which is the stablecoin created by Terraform Labs, was a big moment in crypto. Definitely, you saw that in markets and the price of Bitcoin, Ethereum, and a lot of these tokens dipping after UST depegged. But I think a lot of people viewed the Luna thing as, you know, it was just a flawed design from the beginning. Like, it is not going to necessarily impact the broader crypto community. There were a lot of Luna doubters even in the beginning. They didn't believe in the stablecoin. They didn't invest in the stablecoin. They didn't, you know, put any of their money into the Terra ecosystem. But when you had a project that was worth tens of billions of dollars and it basically overnight goes to zero, a lot of people did worry about potential contagion. Who were the people that were heavily invested in UST and Luna? And now, gosh, if they've been completely wiped out, like, what is the next domino to fall? There were some parties that were very directly affected by that. And one of those was the Aeros Capital, which had been a very outspoken supporter of Luna. And Sam Bankman-Fried, he was kind of always very heavily involved in the Solana ecosystem, which was kind of a competitor to Terra and Luna. And I think it was viewed that, gosh, like, Sam was able to dodge this Luna bullet. This is what people believed. And he is now in a relative position of strength. I don't think people even at that time anticipated how many dominoes would fall. but it was definitely the first, oh gosh, maybe we're in a bear market moment.
In the wreckage of that, we lose Three Arrows. We watch Celsius fail, Voyager fail, BlockFi fail. And then something amazing happens. A guy by the name of Sam Bankman-Fried says, okay, there's a lot of failure going on, but I am well capitalized, and I want to step in here and offer some rescue financing to these different companies that are failing. Sam makes the strategic decision that he's going to start bailing out some of these weaker players. Okay, now this has an incredible effect on his image. He's now coming in as a good Samaritan. He's now coming in as a white knight. The myth in the marketplace is he's made money off the debacle. What we don't know at the time is that he's hurting alongside of these people, but he's now decided he's going to use client money to backstop his personal account, and therefore he's then going to use that client money to buy these distressed assets. And he thinks that this is going to be a win-win. He's going to save the marketplace. He's going to use his clients' money, unbeknownst to them, to buy these assets, which will stabilize the industry, and it'll cause a reflotation or a movement up in asset prices. And in the process of doing that, his reputation is growing, his market share is growing, and even though the cryptocurrency markets are down 40%, he's generating the same level of revenues because his volumes are up 40%. The marketplace is down, but he's gaining market share because people perceive him to be a very safe pair of hands, and it's a company that's looking for seeking American regulation. He's going to Washington regularly. He's sleeping on his brother's couch in Washington, but he's showing up with a ill-fitted suit to all these different testimonies, different hearings, and he's preaching the good cause. He's preaching ethical values, and I'm a man of high integrity, and I'm well capitalized, and I'm going to use my capital to help preserve and backstop the industry. I think he does it for three reasons. Number one, it's great imaging. Oh my God, this is another example of this very well-capitalized man, a much smarter risk manager than his peers. Number two, he really believes this is going to help stabilize the industry. And of course, that's going to help him at Alameda with his positions, because if the industry stabilizes, it will levitate the value of the positions that he holds at Alameda. And then the third reason he's doing it, he likes the attention. He's addicted now to the attention. He's addicted now to the upward-looking view that people have of him. He's on this very high exalted mountain as a guru and a billionaire and a young, insightful entrepreneur of the future. And so people are gazing upward at him, and he likes the genuflection that's taking place. And so he's doing it for those reasons. This is going over very well in Washington. It's going over very well with the American media. He's getting invited on television often. He's getting invited to conferences like Goldman's conference and Morgan Stanley's conference and this conference and that conference. He's speaking at the Economic Club in Miami, and his star is rising. He's ending up on the cover of Fortune, on the cover of Forbes magazine. He's the young new billionaire of the new generation that's going to create this next generation cryptocurrency exchange. So very well thought of guy, eccentric, no doubt, very smart, very well thought of.
In a move reminiscent of J.P. Morgan's bank bailouts during the 1907 pre-FDIC crisis, Sam Bankman-Fried and his FTX are swooping in with hundreds of millions of dollars in rescue funding to try and save distressed crypto firms and bolster an entire sector, leading to comparisons to everyone from J.P. Morgan to Warren Buffett.
There was a period of time when almost every crypto headline had to do with Sam Bankman-Fried, because he was in talks to extend an emergency credit line to BlockFi. He had been interested in bailing out Voyager and kind of acquiring their customers and kind of helping Voyager out. And there was a period of time where kind of his white knight narrative got him on the cover of Fortune magazine with the tagline, is Sam Bankman-Fried the next Warren Buffett? He tried really hard to cultivate that white knight narrative.
Now, the irony is that he's hurting. And the irony, his positions are failing, just like the positions are failing at Three Arrows and Voyager and these other places. But he's got this honeypot of other people's money that he's moving over to his personal account to make up for the losses. Meaning, okay, I'm levered, I have a margin call, but how do I make up that margin call? Let me take the money out of unwitting clients of FTX. I'll move the money from their accounts into my account to protect my inventory. And so he's doing that. By the way, he also was experiencing a little bit of a shortfall. So he very confidently went to people like myself and said, I just raised $1 billion, but I'm interested in extending the round and raise another $1 billion. Well, why, Sam, do you need the money? No, I do not need the money, but I would like to have dry gunpowder to use to potentially buy more distressed assets or to just have as a capital backstop during these times. Okay, so what we now know with hindsight is that he actually did need the money. He had burnt a hole in his balance sheet and he had eroded customer capital and he needed that money to help make up the gap. His audited financials were showing him making $1 billion of revenues for FTX. Now, I actually think those numbers were true. I think that those were one of the few numbers that were not misstated. I actually think those numbers were true. He had just done a round of $400 million at a $32 billion valuation, but he blew through that. He tried to pretend that he didn't. He tried to say that he had that cash still available on his balance sheet, but he wanted to raise another billion at that $32 billion valuation because he said that this was an opportune time to do it. And so the $1 billion of revenues that FTX was making was being valued in the marketplace at 32 times. And so that's where the $32 billion valuation came from. And obviously, again, this is hindsight. He has a God complex. He's thinking he's smarter and he thinks he's better than everybody. And he thinks he has a license to do this. Okay, because it's going to make him very, very rich and he's going to use his money to give it out to other people. And so, of course, he's now he's doing what sociopaths do. They equivocate and they self-justify their bad actions. I'm taking money that does not belong to me and I'm putting it in my account. Well, that's okay because I'm Sam Bankman-Fried. I have a God complex and I'm going to know exactly the right moment to put that money back in the account. So I'm just really borrowing it for a few moments. I'm such a genius. I'll make money off of that money and then I'll put the money back in their accounts. But he's not able to do that, of course, because this is the stock market. This is the cryptocurrency market. So what do we know about markets? Markets are like water. Water always sinks to the lowest level. The markets are a predation on weakness. If you're a weak holder in the market finds you and flushes you out.
To modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.